could start to say before the tape ran out. We found that it's very good to try and line up two meetings a night. One, say, at 7 o'clock and the other at 8:30. And, of course, sometimes you can't do this because people are too tired and they want to go to bed. But wherever you can...
Well, supposing you have, let's say, 15 or let's say 20 families, I mean, could that be called just one meeting a night when you have all these families in there?
Well, maybe if you have that many people, you might your meeting might automatically run on for quite a long time, you know. So if you had that many people, you wouldn't be able, perhaps, to have a second meeting anyway. But the trouble with that is that you never know ahead of time how many of them are going to be there. But by lining up two meetings a night, then if one of them falls through, pardon me, my dental work is falling out. One of them falls through, then you got the other one to fall back on. So you haven't lost the night. Unless they both fall through.
These are just house meetings. This is not the
organizing meeting. No, we're still on the. We're going to be on the house meetings for quite a while. And the other reason for having a house meeting, this two house meetings, is to speed up the whole work. Because what you're trying to do is to create a momentum, a movement within the colonia, whatever the community is where you're working. The faster you can get to the most people, the faster the word is going to start spreading around that there's a movement going, there's something happening here. You heard about this, you know, they'll start talking about it. And the more people you can get to on this basis by a very close contact with them so that you get to know them a little bit and maybe you get to know their names. We'll talk about that later too. And they are willing to talk about their problems and find out something about the program, then they are in a position to go out and start telling other people about it. Whereas if you try and hold a big mass meeting, you know, maybe you'll get a lot of people at that mass meeting. But when they go out of that mass meeting, they won't know much more about what went on than they did when they first came in, because they haven't had a chance to discuss it and think it through and find out what it's all about. And so, well, like they can at a small meeting where they can ask all the questions that they want to, all of them that come to their minds. So as you move into it in the neighborhood, you're going to find that it's going to get easier and easier to hold more than one meeting a night, because as this Stanley Party pattern begins to branch out, you're probably going to have to start spacing your house. You're going to have so many that you can't have them all. Even this week, you got to start planning to scheduling them for the week that's coming up. And that's when this business that you're talking about comes in handy, about dropping back. If you've got a house meeting a week in advance, you've got to drop by that place a couple of times during the week to remind them about getting those people there the night that you're there, like Caesar told you. On Saturdays and Sundays, you can probably hold house meetings during the day. I don't know how it is here. Friday night is a very bad night back east. It seems to be worse than Saturday night. It's pretty hard to hold meetings. It's easier to hold them on Saturday night back east, but out here I think Saturday night is just about out for, I don't know, it is in California, pretty much. But Sunday night is usually all right. Saturday and Sunday during the daytime are okay. Before we go into what goes on at the house meeting itself, would some of you like to ask any questions or bring up anything that we have covered so far?
Mr. Ross, I want to say, I will be dealing with Indian people and I will with me all my adult life. And so many things that you say, I want to know, because I will have Mexican people, no doubt, in that area, but that was the original designation, someone to contact the Indian. through their way of living, it's going to obviate. I can't tell them, now look, all these years that people don't call on one another. Nobody goes to the other person's hometown or house if they live in town. But they're great for meetings. All over the Navajo Reservation, they put in chapter houses, and they will attend. As you say, a meeting starts at 2. They're still in store at 4. They haven't gone yet. But then they'll meet long at their own good time. Now they have lights sometimes 9, 10 o'clock at night. So if you have a minute, any of you men, after this is over, then I need a little more counseling how to approach that, because it's, I'm afraid I can't work the house meeting factor. I don't think in those terms.
Nobody ever comes to visit them, huh? They don't visit.
No, they do not visit, except it's a clan relative.
Yeah, well, that's all right.
Or a ceremony, the same or something like that. Mm-hmm. And see, clan relatives come, but the idea, they haven't progressed maybe to that stage. Pueblos visit, like the villages, they visit a video because they live right together.
Mm-hmm.
Now those are nomadic. Yeah, but just the only time you went to see anybody would be an urgency or because the medicine man was there and it was a sing or something like that. So they've carried that into town because I did have the housing in at Belmont. 200 Navajo houses, even 100 Hopi houses. Nobody ever visits. They have come to see me. I had a little office. They come in there and visit quite a little bit, maybe up to 5 or 6. This would be ideal. A person could get located in this little Navajo community because I don't anticipate much help with Hopis. They go home and eat things there, up Second Mesa. The two tribes don't mix too well. Your real poverty situation is with the Navajo. Perhaps you could advise me. I'll learn because now this morning, if I digress just a minute, we're going to talk about a doctor from the university that we see the mayor or the service club and things like that. That would all be well, but not with them because they couldn't care less whether or not the mayor is or they're in town, the wife's washing dishes, the husband might not be doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
Laid off the railroad. Mm-hmm. We laid off for the long, in the Santa Fe, Southern Pacific, any of them will take you. Augmentation put a lot of them out, and the booze put the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a real challenge, and I'm about to turn my soup last night because here I'm going to be confronted with some problems I think I know something about.
Mm-hmm.
I should. I'm mm-hmm. too stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I want to do this according to the book, and this is a tried and true system. I'm just afraid, and I'll try it. And I know a lot of those people. I was at, well, down the river from Winslow. I was at Indian Wells 11 years. He lived out playing. He'll come and see me.
Well, what are these clans that you talk about that they will come, their own immediate kinsmen?
Well, they have two relationships, blood and clan. And clan, they're matriarchal people. They take their clanship through the mother. And quite often that's more common. In other words, the Navajo has his brothers and clan are just as much his brothers and sisters as
blood
brothers and sisters.
Uh-huh.
And they formally, I think that's, they never had the chiefs as such.
Uh-huh.
The head of a clan, maybe the head of maybe 30 outfits, that's a white, Pelagana's term for camp would be an outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, even though there's 6 Hogans, they're pretty well spread, but that is all one up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is sort of separated a little bit. But you'd be amazed. You talk to one fellow lives right in the camp. The other hope man's only 100 yards over now. The other son's over 6. I don't know. I haven't seen him. He doesn't go to his work.
But the blood kin and the clan will visit back and forth.
Not so much the blood kin as the clan. Then you see in a railroad center, what they call a division point, like they could come from 150, well, there are two tall lines that have been laid off the railroad, and they're like all peoples.
Wow.
They start to come to Valley now, in the Yuma area. The first few years they all go back, and each time a few more of them stay. That's why you have these settlements along reservation border towns, and they're miserable. You've read about them. Gallup is the worst. He's worse than That's disgraceful.
Well, you'd be working within a very, very scattered situation with people living 50
or... I haven't discussed it too much with Reverend Lundgren. The reason that I was grounded with a heart attack and was going to retire, the doctor said, you can't retire, you can do active, not sure. Well, you've got to work. So when I saw this paper, I contacted him.
Mm-hmm.
Because I saw there would be, and the way this evolved, the ministry as such, the city of Winslow a number of years ago provided a building. It's the only, there's none in Flagstaff, none in Holbrook, or none in Winslow, mm-hmm. Northern Arizona. They donated a building for a little community center.
Mm-hmm.
And the city of Winslow, first paid a caretaker, as Reverend Lundgren told me, right now there's a Mennonite couple who donated 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't been successful. I mean, they've had the drunk problem and mm-hmm. a lot of these different problems. It's just been a place, you know, you had to shake out a drunk art. There's only one toilet facility, I believe, and it's not too much for women who have babies to change and a place to rest. If you ever think of it, of course, I go on the entrance, maybe you know these conditions. Navajo, who comes off the reservation to town, the only place he has to go to Tarlis to a bar.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought that's why they got tricked up so much for being drunk, because the average fellow gets drunk, you go to a motel or you get off the street, but they don't have any place.
Yeah.
They're put out of that bar.
Yeah.
Just give them 5 minutes. If they don't get off the street, get over the river or something. They have it.
Yeah. Well, but maybe we better not talk anymore about your problem, because I can see this is going to be a long, drawn-out situation.
I
and the rest of them are not going to be too interested in it. And,
you know,
and we don't know enough about you. Don't know enough about what you're going to do up there yet.
I don't worry about it.
No, I mean whether you're going to be working in with a group of settled families living in close proximity to each other, or whether they're all going to be scattered out, and some of them living on the reservation, some of them not, and it seems to be a pretty confused situation.
They are in town, but they all come and go.
As far as you know, the ones you'll be working with will live in town. Is that
yes.
right?
That's the south side of Winslow. There's a pretty bad area out in there. I'm sorry, the airport.
And that's where you'll probably, but you're not sure yet.
I haven't been up there. Of course, see, I was just a few miles north of Winslow.
Yeah, but no, I mean, do you know what your assignment is?
Winslow, Arizona. That's all. Go up there and work on this child daycare and all that. And they do have a little Indian center.
No, but I mean, by center, do you mean cluster of families, or?
No, the town had a building, and they called it the Indian Center.
Oh, I see.
Now, the tribe as such, I believe, has a program going. It's something I must worry about, not step on their toes.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have a big grant about this.
I see.
They may be, from now on, getting underway. I mean, past experiences and the criterion.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, if I stepped on their toes, they'd be right. Take care of our own Indian dog, I'll be honest, the other way. The reservation line is 16 miles north of Winslow.
I see.
And it's a south boundary line.
And about how many families are there living right in Winslow?
I'm going to judge on the same population basis. They have about 8,000 to 10,000 people in the town. And Holbrook has about 70 Indian families. As I told one of the gentlemen this morning I ride with, the restaurants have to go out of business. The Navajos ever put washing dishes. Every cafe and then all the motels are serviced by inmates.
Mm-hmm.
And they eventually move to town.
Uh-huh.
Even a day-to-day rental basis. Not always pay for the week.
On the part of these families?
Yeah. Oh. They get some of the chicken coop I used to because it usually some guy owns a bunch of trailers. He's converted to store them on a lot. They don't seem to object. I don't know who'd be too, because sometimes one Navajo will rent one of those one-room things and 6-7 of them live there. So
yeah.
The landlord charges an outrageous price, and they stick him because they all move in one. And I don't want to get my problems too confused, but if today and a little bit of tomorrow, Caesar, any of you men, give me some pointers. What am I going to put in a place instead of a house meeting?
Well, you can't tell. How long has it been since you've been up there?
I got through some sheep last fall, October, November.
Well, there seems to be so many unknown quantities right now about just what it is, the situation. But
I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
We
If they, if you can't get them to hold house meetings, and they'll come and see you four or five at a time, why, you know.
They will, particularly women.
Same thing. Well, you shouldn't. Yeah, I know. But
I mean, the you see, they're matriarchal people. Let me explain this. A woman is a boss.
You know? Well, I know that. And that's true in some other groups too, but they
they are the boss. I mean, even BIA's finally found that out among matriarchal people. A man can come and tell you all day long, sure, we'll be at the meeting. If a woman tells you, my family, her family, my sister over here, we'll be there. They'll be there. He tells you that. You might say, well, no, you didn't have any right to tell him there's no reason. I don't want to tell him.
But you can get her to bring him.
That's true. He'll show.
Uh-huh. I was going to say, has anybody ever tried, let's say, to hold meetings in those certain villages or camps? Has anybody ever gone in there and really talked to the people and say, now, can we get together and have a certain meeting? Have you, let's say, you say that they know you and they will come to see you, but have you ever tried to hold a meeting where, let's say, most of them will come to? Perhaps they won't visit to their homes, you know, visit each other. But do you think that for something like this that it's going to work for, let's say, for the community or the village itself to help each other?
You suppose they're confusing Navajos you're confusing Hopis and Navajos. Navajos live in no village. They're antisocial and nomadic people that go with the sheep. Hopis live in a little Navajo town. Freemasons. And those meetings work ideally. That's why they, Quakers, many groups for many years of up there, they attend well. And I think they've accomplished a lot, maybe not as much they thought they did, but anyway, they know the idea of town meetings. They're keen for meetings, different town meetings, many things, but how about it's a problem child. Now, BIA said, we're going to go out and put you up a fine building in every chapter. I was in Indian Wells, but it was an Indian Wells chapter. $40,000-$50,000 in a building. Well, a building is nothing. You give me enough money, I can rebuild Phoenix. They were having probably better meetings by having them outdoors. They were come and go as they pleased, but they put up these elaborate buildings. But I will say they use them. And they meet for hours. Of course, they discuss views of them. I mean, it would seem trivial to us, but they're not to them. That's another problem I'm going to have. But they don't talk.
Pardon?
Talk up. A little thing means so much to them. I mentioned the other day to Gus, one of the biggest things that put the pipeline through on these fellows got in the union, got to wear that little button. I mean, it was a point of distinction. Probably the first time they ever, somebody would call a trading post on the phone and get so-and-so on a job. I don't know the word. It's a big thing, more so than the railroad, because on the railroad, you get up to a race, it was a hurting process.
Do you know, in that community, do you know any of the Indians right now?
Very many. I know many more Indian people than I do.
So probably the best thing there would be to get together with somebody that you do know quite well and get them convinced about this so that they could start going with you to call on people that you don't know to talk about the whole thing. And then during this, it would seem to me that gradually you're going to be able to find out whether it's just a hopeless proposition to try and have a meeting at somebody's house or where the best place. You know, you'll be getting ideas from them, too.
I sort of had in mind this little center.
Yeah. But where the, you mean the one you were telling us about?
This one room they have that hasn't been very adequate. Uh-huh. If they would just start drifting in there all day, all night, it makes no difference to me. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I talk, you know. Pretty good Navajo, there's no language barrier, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. They won't talk that way, that's all right. They and they're aware of all these things. I mean, nothing has been suggested here that they're not aware of, but all there that I've ever known, it's always been somebody come in and say, we're going to give it to you, and they've been doing it until now, it's wrong.
Yeah, I know. So this will be, they probably will be very suspicious of you when you don't do that. And they'll still be waiting to find out what the real gimmick is for quite a while.
I anticipate great suspicion, except
that you do know a lot of them, which is quite an advantage. Yeah, that's right. The other thing that the second, before we go into the house meeting again, the other thing that I said that we wanted to cover was in those areas where you don't have where you do not live, but where you may be working sooner or later, but you don't know any of the people themselves. You can get acquainted with somebody there, like maybe one of the spiritual leaders, maybe the priest or the minister, if there's one there. Maybe you don't want to do that too, but you have to decide whether or not it's worth it. In some communities, you have to be very careful about the ministers that you get to help you, because you make more enemies than friends sometimes. But in others, I know we've been working with the Spanish-speaking people. We've had tremendous success in working with the priest in the village or the barrio, and in many cases he happened to be the only one that at the very beginning we had any contact with at all. We, before we went in there, probably didn't even know him, but we did know other priests in other areas, and perhaps we had a letter of introduction, or even many times without any, just by talking about the other priests that we knew and had been working with. Why, that was helpful. Naturally, when we first started out, we didn't have that. Those of us that had that were Catholic, for instance, like Caesar, had a very good working relationship with the priest in the town where he lived, and other priests knew about him and so on. So it wasn't absolutely cold. And I think eventually you got a letter of introduction from Father McDonald. Yes.
Mr. Ross, what about this rural communities, maybe where these people, the housing is furnished by the farmer? Here's a problem where an employee can be run off the ranch if the farmer sees some threat to his security because of organizing, and this is a question that we...
These are the camps? Are these the camps?
So I'm going to be working on a Stanfield, and mostly all the people that I'll be working is mostly in camps, and whatever the farmer furnishes housing.
Well, in the areas where the farmer furnishes, where it isn't a camp, something else, it would only be a small number in there, wouldn't it?
Well, the camp would be small.
About how many?
Well, in Stanfield, I think there's about three or four that are pretty good size. But then the communities, I don't know how big, I'm not too familiar with it. I have been to there, but I'm not very much familiar with the whole area. In fact, I'm going to go there next weekend.
Well, what would you think, that there might be at least 100 families in each of the camps?
Oh, no, maybe about 20. And the Anderson Ranch is one, and Goff, I think, is another one. It's about three or four. Maybe they're not over 20.
About around 20, 25 families in each camp?
Yeah, well, but these people are in a very... They're living well. They're shacks. I mean, they're not.
Mm-hmm. Do they?
Maybe smaller than this, and maybe there's a family with five or six children, and where the roof leaks, the floor is no good. And these are people that really need work.
And do they live there most of the year?
Most of the year round.
They do.
Some of them live. I think one family that I talked to around their landlord, he says 6 years in this housing. And this, I think, if I'm not mistaken, this man is an ex-Marine and high school graduate. It's really sad.
Uh-huh. And are these camps fairly how far apart are the camps?
Let's see, about 10 miles, apart. And then Maricopa, there's another area, and that's about 30 miles from Stanfield.
No, but these four or five camps that you're talking about are roughly about 10 miles apart, huh? And are they on the outskirts? I mean, around some city, at some town or something?
Stanfield.
I see.
I have 12 camps within a 25-mile radius in Marana, and I have anywhere from 3 or 4 to 50 families in.
In fact, I think
we're still already organized on a community council basis, and each camp has delegates.
Yeah.
We have the same problem because the people there are squatters. The rancher doesn't need them or want them, doesn't employ them at all.
Uh-huh.
And they're simply there as non-rent paying people.
Mm-hmm.
And the rancher would like any excuse to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. On all these camps?
Yes.
Yeah, because they used to be a big farming area, and as the machinery has taken over this, the work that these people used to do, well, there's no need for it. And this is all, they either wheat farming, wheat, cotton, and alfalfa and barley. So there's no work for these people. Maybe for about 2 or 3 weeks a year, I guess. They would rather hire migrants who would come in and move out than have these people stay as squatters and like that.
And that's what they're doing where you are too?
Well, where I'm at, it's mostly they work for the farm there. Mm-hmm.
And what you're bringing up is the problem mainly of being able to work there without getting thrown out.
Well, they haven't thrown out because it doesn't,
but I mean, what I mean is you want to be able to stay there in order to organize them. And what your problem is, how can this be done?
This is what it means.
Yeah, because that would probably be the first that he'd start trying to get rid of you before he'd probably go throw them out, because he'd have some kind of a problem on his hands to try and throw that many people off. Well, we can come back to that. That's a special problem. But
they have an easy way of doing that. All they need to do is go to the county health department or sanitation or any county agency, and they will get an eviction order. They board up the complete camp. Everybody is run out. And this is all very legal. In fact, in most cases, the county health department or sanitation or whatever is very eager to do the same thing. And usually what happens, this goes on that way for a week or maybe 2 weeks, and pretty soon the boards are down and the people are back in. So some ranchers will go on to the extent they bring in a bulldozer and just level the place, which means they go to another camp or to another area and find similar conditions. But this is a very real danger.
If they're not organized, they'll do this. There's this place in Santa Maria. They've been trying to get people out 3 years. They condemn the place. They use everything on the book. They're still there.
Yeah, I know. They come back, to be sure. But if they bring in...
They never left.
They never left because CSO came in there, and then they presented a united front and said, all right, we leave. It's the responsibility of the community. Right? These people leave. Where do they go to? Provide housing, and they leave. They can't provide the housing.
They began talking to them about public housing.
Even, for instance, in California, experience has been even with the within the city limits of an incorporated city. Very often, maybe every 2-3 years, there's a big drive to try to condemn substandard housing. The city won't do it. They can't do it because they're going to create a bigger problem. They just leave them there. So I wouldn't be afraid of that at all. Not at all.
We've lost 3 camps in 2.5 years I've been in Marana. Well, they just brought in bulldozer and level.
Yeah, but
they like that.
But the people were left, before they did that.
No, they weren't. In fact, some of the people were in their house till the bulldozer pushed it down.
Yeah, but you weren't organized.
That's right.
No, and
if the people threw their bodies in front of that bulldozer, that bulldozer would not move.
It stopped.
They tried that in Cleveland. They ran over a guy.
No, that was accidental.
Well,
and he accidentally tripped and fell and that was a minister. No, that was not.
Once you organize them, they won't move.
See,
they will, but then there'll be a big. Well, you have a bigger job than all the community have to provide.
We have another problem in Arcahilla Valley, where most of the land belongs to the farmers, and the land that's for sale is. Got so many restrictions on it by the county that you can't afford to go buy a piece of property because they won't let you even park a trailer on it. So there's another situation. Arcahilla is a big farming community. Jackson and Burton ranch is in there.
That's where we want to go to when we get through here.
Of course, they have very good housing conditions. Jackson and Burton is one of the best.
Yes, it is. Well, what about the camps that you go on this? In my area, I think it's about 4 camps. And they have these no trespassing signs. I mean, the guy, the camp boss, though, he wants you on the camp talking to the people. What do you do about it?
Well, didn't you say you lived in one of these?
No, in the area where I'll be working, there's camps.
Oh, but weren't you one that put up your hand that said that you lived in the area where you were going to work?
I do.
You've been living there?
Around this area, we have some camps that I have to work.
Oh, you have not been living in any of those camps?
No.
Oh, I see. I see.
And I want to know, what about these places where they got camp balls? They got these trespassing signs. They don't want you to interfere with
them. Who are the camp bosses? Aren't they more or less the people who just live in the camp too? Are they big wheels?
Well, it's sort of, they even got the women's camp bosses. They put it pretty reckless.
Well, but you know, you can. Maybe you're just going to have to be a wolf in sheep's clothing for a while.
Sing into it.
No, I mean, you know, there, you may very well get permission, so that he won't be hounding you out of there all the time. Because if he knows that you know that this is part of the poverty program, and it's for the people, and you know, to set up a recreation for them, and I mean, you know, it doesn't make a difference what you tell him, as long as it sounds very mild, and it's for the kids, and you know, and everybody loves the kids, and for, you know, setting up sewing classes and all of this sort of thing. Of course, you may never do any of those things, but by that time, maybe it'll be too late. Once they're organized. Now, I don't say that that's going to be the easiest thing in the world either, because there's always somebody that's going to run and tell the guy too. Do you know very many of the people in these that live in these camps?
No, I haven't dealt with very many of them that live in the camp. Uh-huh. But I know just about all the people just in the community. It's a little seldom, I would say. Mm-hmm. And then around this Buckeye era, they have a shifty camp, and Pawns have a couple of big camps. And actually, I think some of the people that own these camps, they just like, they're trying to get rid of all of the people's own camp. And some of the camps has got restrictions. You know, they come in, if they live there, they have to work there. They got to know what they're doing, and you know, all of the activities, you know, sort of. Personal view.
Mm-hmm. But you do. Do you know at least one person in most of the camps?
Yes, I think so. Uh-huh.
Well, as long as you know one person that you can trust, you got a foot in the door, and he probably knows several people that he can trust, and they know several people that they can trust, and you might be able to make quite a lot of headway before the jig was up, before the word got back, and you might have to go on for quite a while before you actually got into the real reason for organizing. You know, you might, as I said, just have to talk about. What's the racial makeup of the people in these camps? Are they mixed or?
Yes, they are.
They're pretty mixed. Huh? Mm-hmm. Negro and Spanish speaking and Anglo American.
Yeah, I think some all different kinds. Mm-hmm. Drift in. Mm-hmm. Can't go nowhere else. Don't find no, you know, nothing better, and they just stay.
And they live there more or less permanently. Yeah, yeah. And they're growers' camps, and do they usually work for the grower that works for the camp manager is managing it for a grower?
Yes, he takes contracts.
Oh yeah.
And then the people that's on the camp is obligated to him. So he calls them to work, he brings them back. It's like
farm labor contractor camps.
Yeah. Well, you have gotten into many of those. Yeah. Why don't you tell them?
Yeah, I like to. Yeah, that's why I was talking that you could bring this up.
This is one of the good things about holding house meetings, is that usually by the time you get
what you wanted, I mean, it's too late for the opposing faction to do anything against you. For instance, in organizing a labor union, it would be doing the same thing you're doing and going to the same place where it can't be sold either by the company or the or by the labor contractor. And what we try to do is, first of all, relate the work there or tie up the work in the camp with the work in the community, whichever community is closest to. And instead of setting up a group in that camp by itself, which could be very well destroyed because they're under the gun, we tie this that group into the community group. Now, if we have two or three men in that camp who come from that camp to the meeting in the community, then they'll be doing the work for you. The people will be coming out of the, you wouldn't even have to go to the camp. Usually what we do is we go in and we have a guy who takes a tape recorder and he demonstrates tape recorder, see if he gets caught. Usually what he's doing talking union. We had a strike we just ended yesterday, and we had to go into the community where the boss, this is even worse, it's in the community, but we have a cop in each of the homes that we have to visit of the strike breakers to try to convince them. And the report is that we're intimidating people. So we sent some of our members who are not known to the cops, and they go in with a briefcase or one had a tape recorder. And he went inside and he recorded everything that the guy told him. And what they were doing inside was he was banging away trying to get him to stay away from the job. But when he came out, the cop came to the door and said, "No, I was here conducting an interview for a radio program." And and he got the job done.
He got the what?
He got the job done.
But he had already recorded what
was it? Well, the business of recording is that signing something is that the guys can do whatever he said is on tape, you know. Mm-hmm. We can't sue him, but we can sure play it back in some day. So you don't have the same situation. So if you're not known as a labor union, you can go in and have a ball in there before they do anything. Now, if you organize a labor union, then you got to work away with them.
And in a case where the people are not working for the rancher, they're paying no rent, no utilities, what recourse do you have even if they are organized? Organized for what? Against what?
Well, didn't you say there were quite a few of these camps, anywhere from a few families up to 50? Yeah. 50 people? Wow. You know,
they're all permanent residents. They've been there for the last 4 or 5 years. In fact, they're just now becoming eligible for welfare assistance, which in Arizona is 5 years residence.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe that's one of the things I'm going to fight. And it won't be until you talk to them that you really know what they want, you know.
Well, I've talked to them the last 2.5 years, the rancher as well as the people. And I know both the rancher and the people quite well. And we have worked out the problem with programs. We have a clinic, and we teach adult education and children education and everything else. But still, this doesn't solve the basic problem of housing, jobs, etc.
Well, they're not organized. How can you know? You're doing it for them.
But organized for what?
For power.
To do what?
Well, for one thing.
There's no jobs.
No, I know that, but there's a supervisor over that area, you know, who runs for office. And once they've been in the state for a year, if they can read and write a little bit, vote. You can get them.
Except the Yaqui.
Huh?
Except the Yaqui.
What's the matter with the Yaqui?
They are Mexican nationalists.
No, you're wrong.
Excuse me, friend.
Not in this country.
Try and get them to get them to vote.
Oh, well, we did already. Tell them what
you
we
know
did.
About in the state, they did.
We have a coffee paper of the hammering there. They're putting a hat there. We've got some coffee in here.
Okay.
They have modified the law for you. Anybody can vote out. No more reading.
Better do this anyway, then I don't feel so tired.
Can I say something here?
You bet.
if you wanted to, this evening, some of the fellows, if they feel they have to go, the ones that don't can eat supper and then come back or meet you in your motel or somewhere. And some of them might like to discuss with you.
Well, we'd like to talk to Caesar tonight and to Mr. Ross tomorrow, because there's some things we'd like to get from Caesar yet, but I think they are very good for some of us that are around town here. That are going to be here, and from Mr. Ross, I think there's some other things we'd like to get, but we have to kind of stagger him because, I mean, we can't. So he can rest tonight, maybe, and Caesar can rest tomorrow night.
Well, why don't we have Caesar take over tomorrow?
Okay. That's the way you want that. We'll do that.
We can do that. But what I thought today, you see, we got interrupted. What we want to do is to go through a pattern which has been successful both in the rural areas and in the cities. I mean, it's applicable all over. And then, after we go through that, then we can begin to talk about the individual particular situations, like the one you brought up, the one you brought up, the one you brought up, and so forth. See how they will fit into this pattern. There's a way that it could be worked out. It just has to be done, that's all. But the first thing that you've got to get through your heads is that unless power is built, you might as well just forget it, because we're not going to be going out and giving handouts to people. They've got to get it for themselves with whatever help that we can give them. And before they can get it, they have got to have the power to move and force, whether it's to demonstrate or whether it's to just through the sheer power of their vote, be able to put enough pressure on the politicians and so forth to get them to move in certain directions. And you'd be surprised. You might think, well, in certain things they'd be able to do, but other fields they can't. Well, when those politicians really want those votes, they can get into practically any field and do something. I think so. If you can hold any particular problems that you have, you know, and if we can just concentrate on questions that you might have about the actual organizing itself, you know, then tomorrow we'll go into the particular problems that each of you have. Is that all right? Do any of you have any questions now about what we've talked about so far that's tied directly into coming up to the time when we hold our first house meeting?
Well, I'm late in asking this question, but I have a question before you start the house meeting.
Yeah, before.
Before you start the house meeting, now this was brought up this morning, Dr. McCann was here, and...
Dr. who?
Dr. McCann.
Oh.
And we'd like to know your opinion, and Caesar's, and the rest of the people that have worked with you, and know your method. Yeah. Is it good to go and explain to the mayor, the town council, and people such as that, what you are going to do, or just real vague outline of what you're going to do? Like, you can tell them, we're coming into Towson, which is my town, that's why I mention it, and we're going to do a survey of the needs of the people. Now, is this good? To go and introduce yourself to them, introduce a little bit of what you're going to do in the town.
Well, what do you think after having the discussion with him? What was his reason for bringing this up?
Well, this is his...
Not method. Just you, but anybody that heard him.
This is the method that was introduced to us this morning. Uh-huh. That is his opinion. He believes that's the best way. I believe that putting the two methods on the block, I believe your method, I'm partial to the way you have established doing these things.
What was his reason for thinking that this should be done? Did he think that it might avoid suspicion and all that?
I think part of what he had in mind was that he would try to solicit their goodwill and their support to begin with. And if he didn't get it, then he said you need to really come in there with some... strength, and as you say, the power of saying, well, we've got this, we've got to do. I think what he had in mind is try it the easy way first. Try to get their cooperation to avoid casualties. Then, if you can't, you may have to have a war. But this is what I understood his thinking was. Try to negotiate first. Then, if you have to resort to war, okay. If not, as opposed to war first, then negotiate.
One of the other things that he brought up was the fact that in some cases, that if you don't at least introduce yourself to the power structure in the community, that you might be knocked off your block before you even get the community organized.
Did he tell you how they might be able to go about knocking you off your block?
He said they would divide the forces. Some of them have influence. If a guy's an employer, somebody in Ellenville, he might start out right at the beginning and divide the community up before it.
Or threaten them to get fired and things like this.
Well, what do you think if you were to go in and talk to the mayor? Who else did he say you ought to talk to? The mayor.
Service clubs.
You're leading your.
The welfare, social service agencies, mm-hmm. and all that.
Your existing power structure.
He characterized it as a community service system. First, leadership structure, value structure, association of system imposed on community service system, which is your existing legal authorities, service clubs, county officials, supervisors.
Well, supposing now that you went to him and told him you were going to do a community survey, is that what he said to tell him?
Yeah, this is what he said. Yeah.
Is that what you're going to do, is do a community survey?
No, I
hope not. Well, that's the first step.
Pardon?
That's the first step, he said.
That's the first step?
Yeah, you call it assessment process of assessing the needs of the community.
Oh, I see.
And from what he said, I got that you're just supposed to tell him about the first step.
Oh. Well, are you planning on going in and making an assessment of the needs of the community?
Well, yes, in the small house meetings. They'll tell you what they need, but the small house meetings are opposed to the power structure in the town knowing the way I grasp it. That the power structure in the town should not know until you have a force behind you ready to bargain with them.
Yeah, because if you tell them you're just going to go in and make a survey, that's a big fat lie, because and they're going to find out about it. Sometimes you may have to do that in connection with one of these camps or something, but when you go around and tell the power structure that you're going to do one thing, and then they're going to find out right away, and if they have the power to stop you, they're going to try to stop you whether you tell them about it right away or not. They're going to try to stop you. And if they have the idea, if they have any inkling that you're going to do any more than make a survey, they're going to try to stop you right away as soon as you tell them. So it would seem to me that there are certain people, however, wait a minute, it would seem to me that's the wrong advice. Follow. We, as a matter of fact, we have never done any of this. It is not our job as organizers to go around and introduce ourselves to the power structure. Our job is to work with the people so that after a while they can go up and introduce themselves to the power structure. They're the ones that are supposed to be having the eyeball-to-eyeball sessions with the power structure. But he's right about, well, I don't know whether he even mentioned this, probably didn't. He's right. I mean, there are certain people that you'll certainly want to make yourselves known to in the community, among the people. And certainly in connection with the Spanish-speaking population, the priest is about the first place you ought to stop. Because that person has definite influence over an awful lot of people in that community. And if you start going around talking to people, some of them are going to go right back to him and find out, who are these guys? Are they a bunch of communists, or what are they? You know. And then he gets all excited, you know, and maybe a lot of damage is done before you even get started there. So that if there is a spiritual leader in that community where you're working, who has, in your opinion, quite a sizable congregation, it's very important to talk to him first. If you don't know anybody, then he'll be able to help you get to people.
But if he turns up, he'll be against you from the very start.
Well, it's been our experience that with very, very few exceptions, the spiritual leaders are not against you on this kind of a program.
Well, could I have some that are in Eloi? It's kind of my own denomination. You don't see that at all.
Well,
what Fred's saying here is that those spiritual leaders who are involved with the people you'll be working with,
yeah,
not necessarily in the community, but involved and they have in their congregations the same people that you'll be working with.
Well, I think it's good. I think we ought to see them, but I'm just saying, what's the alternative now?
Well, what I'm talking
about, I'm anticipating running into opposition from these people too, spiritual leaders.
Well, are these spiritual leaders you're talking about, do they have in their congregation the poor people that you'll be working with?
Not the one I was talking with, but if he's this way, I suspect the other. Maybe not at all.
Well, we've talked to two priests, Father Gervais, and I talked to Father McShane in Towson, and of course this was in confidence, and they're available. They like the idea very well, and they both promised, well, you were, when we talked to both of them, you were there.
And
they like the idea, and they're all for it, and they'll help us as much as they can.
But and I had the same experience at Stanfield when Reverend Martin and I went over there. The minister named Stanfield, Reverend Martin, he felt that we should go in the same way that you talk. That because if the farmers become aware of the fact that you are trying to organize these people, it's a threat to their security. And he felt the same way that you think, that we should go in and do as much as we can and organize them, and because they're going to find out anyway, but at least you have
gone. You got to jump on them.
That's right. This is the way that he felt it should be done.
He's leaving next week, too.
Too bad.
Well,
that's
when Gus is going.
See, this points up once again the point I made a little while ago about the great need for pushing your organizing drive just as fast as you possibly can, having as many house meetings every day and working 7 days a week right straight through a 5-week period probably, to get as many people contacted and to get them organized as fast as you can before they find out what it is that you're doing.
Then it's too late.
Then it's too late. Right. Well, it's not completely too late, but you've gotten over the first big hump, and then we'll come to the next one, which is building the second kind of power. Once you've got the second kind of power built, why, it usually is too late. But did you want to say anything about contacting the power structures
here? Oh, I just want to say one thing. This might sound kind of far-fetched, but it has been true in three cases we've had. We sent a guy in to organize a small community, and he went in to see the chief of police because he thought that if I have him on my side, I can almost do anything. And it turned out to be that they both of them played golf, and they started playing golf, and then they became pretty good friends. And then they were pretty good friends, and then there were a lot of cases of the people that were working with on police brutalities, and people were complaining how the cops were roughing them up, you know. They never got to the chief of police because the organizer couldn't afford to. He was his friend, you know.
He was under obligation.
Under an obligation. He contracted an obligation unknowingly, and it's pretty hard to break it. Pretty hard to break it.
Then,
can
I say one thing? I think it's in this respect, excuse me for interrupting, but in this respect, that's why it's important that you never drop the mister or the reverend. And they start calling by first names.
Pardon?
In this respect, that's why you should always call, keep the mister before the person's name.
Oh, I
see.
That
way you don't become a
buddy. I see, yeah.
Instead of calling over here and calling him Harold, pretty soon your buddy. You
yeah.
Keep the reverend.
Yeah.
You always.
the danger is
every course.
The danger is here is that it wasn't planned this way. It wasn't a planned thing, you know. It just happened this way. And so he literally told the people down the river as far as that, you know, problem was concerning the community. And in fact, nothing was ever done until much later when he left.
The other thing is that none of these outfits in the power structure have any kind of a decent relationship with the people that we're working with. You know, none of them belong to service clubs. Maybe they might let them sweep the floor after they get through meeting or something, but they wouldn't say that. And the social workers, well, you know the kind of relationship the social workers have with them. And same way with, well, and then of course as far as the mayor and the city councilman are concerned, they might immediately get the idea that maybe they can use you to help them build up their machine out there in the neighborhood so that you'll get more votes next time or something like this. So they might want to try to start using you on that. So any way you look at it, it's just a very unwholesome situation as far as working with the people out there in the neighborhood are concerned. There isn't any way, for the most part, that any of those people can really influence the people down at the bottom that we're working with. You know, they haven't got anything to lose, so the threats, for the most part, that some of them might give, unless it happens to be their employer, you know, once in a while, that might come up. But actually, you don't have anything to gain by wasting time talking to these people, and you have a lot to lose if you're not careful.
Oh. Stretch a little bit, oh. So.
But be sure and remember about the, particularly the priest in the Spanish-speaking neighborhoods, because I don't know what the situation is among the Protestant ministers in poor neighborhoods. For the most part, I guess it would be mainly the holiness people, the Pentecostal group, and. Sometimes it's very often it's very hard to work with that group because they've got, you know, the pie in the sky deal. They want to talk about, you know, the hereafter always. But after, very often after the organization has gotten set up, you can get them involved. And sometimes you can get them involved right at the very beginning if they aren't too fanatical about that, you know, about this. The afterlife and so on.
Also, Fred, it's been an experience that you set up a good group and you start helping people with their own individual problems, that minister in that Pentecostal group, because he's dealing with people, with the poor people, he has the same problems, and too often he doesn't know how to solve them, so he will welcome this kind of a group being formed in his community. Not immediately, but after he knows that he's not being threatened.
And the same way
it the end works.
The same way with the priest, who is taking care of the people's problems day after day. He gets so many, you know, he has to spend so much time taking care of individual social problems, he doesn't have time to do his religious work. So that they welcome an organization like this after they find out, you know, that what it's going to do. Okay, well, why don't we get into the house meeting itself? We've talked about ways of selling the people, the individual, you know, family that we've talked to, persuading them to hold the meeting, and we talked about reminding them during the week and on the night that they're supposed to have the house meeting, and we've talked about how Caesar actually went out and when he found out that there wasn't going to be any house meeting unless he took the lady by the hand and went out and went around quickly and picked up the people and brought them to the house, which he had to do sometimes. And we talked about the advisability after you get into it of lining up two house meetings a night, so in case one falls through, why, you'll still have the other one. and of being able to hold them on Saturday and Sunday in the daytime, or in some communities where there's an awful lot of unemployment, where you can hold them day and night because there's some people are just around, and there's no sweat about having house meetings in the daytime too. In other words, all you're doing, as I say, is trying to build this momentum and get it going faster and faster and faster with more and more people, right up to the organizing meeting. Peter, why don't you give them an idea then what usually goes on in a house meeting?
Let's have a house meeting.
Yeah. Going to role play, Caesar?
Well, once you've been successful in getting people to hold a house meeting, I think one of the things, the first thing to remember is that it's not going to be a large meeting unless there's some unforeseen circumstances that brought more people than ordinarily come together. But in our experience, there's never been more than 20, and this is not very often. But you'll have 3 or 4 or 5 people at this house meeting. I think your house meeting will determine not only if the organization is going to get started, but also if people are going to become involved in it. I think too often at a house meeting you want to do too much, and you get and the people who will come to the house meeting will get lost and will consequently will not understand any of the things that you're trying to tell them. So my first advice would be to, in your own mind, have a well-planned idea that you're going to speak with a view that you will get them into action before the house meeting is over. After you give them the preliminary and some of the things that can be done, then towards the last part of the meeting, they will also be participating. We never take notes, and I'm not saying you shouldn't, but we never take any written notes at the meeting, but we try to retain some of the things that they say and remember, because this is, you're filing this away, this is going to be used later on. Some of the problems, some of the things that they come up with, some of the names. I would have to use a typical CSO meeting, and I think it applies pretty much with it. We would come in after the meeting set, and usually we know one person, which is in most cases the owner of the house where the meeting is being held. We tell them who we are. Introduce ourselves to those present and try to get their names. And then we open up the house meeting with a conversation of what has happened in the past. But very brief, for instance, well, all of us know that these things are not right. And all of us know also that some groups, for some reason, are doing something for themselves. Not necessarily in the same community or the same state, but somewhere in the country, some groups are fighting to get rid of these problems. And then,
by the way, you can all use Guadalupe here in case you're going to be out there. You're going to see. You're going to hear all about it and so on.
If you have that, well, you can start naming examples of how the people start doing something for themselves. At all times, you shouldn't. In your talk, you should never promise things you can't keep. Definitely not. Or make statements that you won't remember next day what you said to them. Because some of the things that they'll be asking are very important to them, and if you commit yourself, you have to, if you want to continue your house meetings and continue to have the people respect, you have to come through with those things that you're promising them. Then also, after you talked about the past, then you will talk about, well, in this case, you'll use Guadalupe, and you'll say, point out maybe two or three of the things that they've done there so far. And you're saying that you're there to talk to them to see if they would like to get together and try and get some of these problems done away with.
Can I ask you a question here? What are the reasons for no note-taking or writing down names in a house meeting?
Well, in the beginning they don't know you, and you start writing, you know. What was that again? You know, you start taking notes, and pretty soon they start holding back, and they won't
down. A tape recorder there, huh?
Oh, yeah, something like that.
But taking down names and addresses.
Oh, yes, names
and
addresses.
Yeah, names and addresses is what I had.
After, that's the...
hard for me to remember names.
Well, after you get through the meeting, you know, the ice has been broken by then, you start taking the names and addresses. Yeah. Or in some appointments, a personal problem comes and you want to handle the problem. If it's something minor, you want to do it right away, maybe tomorrow in the morning. You think it's something very important, then for example, take notes on that. But they'll probably separately or individually with one of the participants.
Let me ask you something. I noticed that Mr. Ross and Lalo and yourself, whenever you get introduced to a person, most of the time you ask them his name again. Now, are you associating that name with something so you can remember it, or do you just want to make it clear in your mind what the man's name is, the pronunciation?
Both. For me.
Both. Now, do you use a system for this, for association of names?
No. No, but by just repeating it once, it helps you keep that in mind, because maybe you'll meet a room full of people. Maybe you'll meet five or six different people. And it's very important for you to be able to remember their names at the end of that meeting. So when you say goodnight, you know, you don't have to look at the list and say, let's see, now, oh, Mrs. So-and-so and so-and-so, go down the list. It's very important for you to be able to, you know, call them by their names when you leave there. It helps. A lot. It makes them feel that you are interested in them, or else you wouldn't be even remembering their name. Well, any, you know, that's a traveling salesman has this same situation.
Anybody else have questions? I was going to continue with the conversation at the house meeting. Specifically, I can't tell you what I think you'll be telling people, because I don't know what you'll be selling to them. The only thing we know is that you'll be organizing them. And, generally, we know, for instance, that in some communities you'll have the garbage situation, in other communities you'll have the police case, in other communities you'll have a playground. But in other communities here in Arizona, you'll have one thing, one question will be asked of you, and you have to, even before you go out there, get a pretty good answer for it. And they'll ask you, what about wages? But by using Guadalupe as an example, and I don't know specifically that much about it, but I know that it's not any different than California. When you get through with this, then one of the most important things you can do at the meeting, besides, for instance, telling them that there's going to be a meeting later on, if a lot of people get interested, and you want to talk to everyone, that you're interested in talking to everyone, and listening to the complaints. At the end, you'll also be wanting to get them hooked on holding a house meeting for you. And this is where you really got to do the job. If you don't hear, you're going to work twice as hard getting it. You create sort of a chain reaction thing. You know, it's a continuity of house meetings. And you say, well, for instance, I'm not going to ask Mr. Padilla to hold a house meeting again, because he already did his part. He held his meeting. And of course, thank you for it. But I'm going to ask some of you people to hold house meetings. You try to get volunteers, and if they don't volunteer, then you try to recruit them yourself by putting some firm pressure, but in a very gentle way. For instance, all we're asking here, no money. We don't want you to sign up anything. We just want to talk to people. And if I knew the people in the community, I wouldn't be asking. I'd do it myself, but I don't know. Well, my house is too small. This is one. Or, I don't know anyone. Or, I'll let you know. And those three things, you know, aren't answers at all. For instance, yes, I'll let you know. And they say, well, you get your book in. Would Tuesday be all right next week at 7 o'clock at night? Well, I don't know, but I'll let you know. Then you've got a house and you have to pin him down, the time, the date, and so forth. And also, the one that comes up with the answer that he doesn't know too many people in the community, usually that's not true. Then you say, well, yes, what about, do you have any brothers?
Oh, yeah.
Any married sisters? Yeah. Your mom, your dad?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, you have a house meeting right there. When you talk to people, they think that you're asking them to bring the whole town, you know, their house, or people that are not related to them. And the whole business of the house, you know, this is something that you get usually someone who's interested and thinks he's going to have a house meeting, and those times when you get people to come to the house meeting, but the only thing about it is that for the first time, maybe, some stranger is going to come into the house, and the house is small. So you have to assure him that it doesn't matter a bit how small it is or how bad of a shack it is. That the important thing is to get people together, you know. And
sometimes, if you haven't had much luck in selling them on the idea of holding a house meeting, then the meeting part is over and you're just sitting around talking and people are talking to each other. Sometimes you can sort of edge in next to a person and start talking to that person. And after the regular meeting is over and convince them, and then go around and sit next to somebody else, and sometimes you have to do it that way in order to put in that little extra.
And people won't come. Sometimes well, we have a guy who turns out to be a terrific leader after you get the thing going. But at that first house meeting, he was bashful. He just couldn't get himself to say a word. And you sort of look at him if he's interested. You want to see him again. Unless you're pretty sure, you know, for whatever reason you have, the guy is really out, you probably would want to call on him again at some other time, maybe the following day, or maybe in the evening, before you go to the following evening, before you go to the next meeting, come by and say, hi, how are you? Then you have, for instance, once in a while you'll get a drunk who will come in and take over the house meeting. And we'll have the guy who knows everything and also take the house meeting over. Or something happens at the house.
Don't leave
the stairs,
tell us what you do.
and also, something happens, an accident, right outside the door, you know, and that ruins the meeting for a while. And if something very serious, like a fire, people want to go, you know, or the TV playing. I do it, so the TV's playing, we're going to the house, I just get up and turn the TV off. You know, if anybody's listening to it anyway, you know, come over, sit down. So, I mean, you got to be in control of the meeting. If you're not, you're dead. Somebody whether it's dozing off or there's a sort of a second house meeting, a sub house meeting going on. You know? If you can control that, you're dead. You've got to be in control of that meeting. Absolute control. Otherwise, by control, I mean that people've got to be listening to what you're saying, or at least looking at you, you know.
Let me tell them how I control the drunk ones.
Yeah.
This wonderful priest in California by the name of Father McCullough was working among some ex-cons and people on the borderline, either in or out, just out of jail, or that particular group of people. So he lined up a house meeting for me at their house in Stockton, this was. And when I got there was only one guy there. And he was sitting in the front room with just one light, just a kind of a dim bulb there in the front room. And in the other rooms, it was just darkness back in there. You couldn't see anything. And I was talking to him, and we kept waiting and waiting, and nobody showed up. Along about a half an hour later, I just happened to look around, and there was another guy there. I didn't know where he came. He just materialized, you know. And so I kept talking to the guy, and I looked around again. Well, here's somebody else. He just materialized out of the gloom there someplace. I didn't know where they came from. And after a little bit, three guys came in sort of supporting a drunk. And of course, you know, he started taking over right away. And interrupting all the time. I'd only get about five words out of my mouth, and he'd interrupt. And all the people, the other guys there, got a big kick out of this because they didn't care about me. I mean, it was fun for them, you know, to watch this guy operate this way. And then all of, then I just happened to get onto a subject that they got real interested in. It happened to be the police. I couldn't have hit, of course, I did it on purpose. I couldn't have hit on a better subject than they. And I started talking about this police brutality case and involving seven young men in Los Angeles that were beaten up all night long, the jails there, and then how the organization got to work on it and wound up eventually by sending five of those police officers to jail for from 1 to 10 years. Well, as soon as I started talking about that, as soon as I got into that, this drunk kept trying to interrupt. Well, he interrupted about twice more. They told him to shut up. It changed completely. Shut up, and he didn't shut up. Well, two of them got up and dragged him out and threw him out of the house. That was the end of him. A lot of times, if you can try and figure out something that will catch him, something exciting, you know, to make him want to hear, they'll get rid of the drunk for you themselves.
Or also play up to the, this is a guy who's drunk, and he has two bad points, two strikes against him. He's drunk, but also, even if he weren't drunk, he'd be doing the same thing because he knows everything and everyone. He has the answers for everything.
What do you do in a situation like this when a certain person, like you say, thinks he knows everything, but really doesn't know anything? If a person can write, can read, but he thinks he knows a lot of things, and he's against the government, whether it's doing good or bad, he just thinks that we're just living in a communist country or something like that. And if you try and say something that's, for example, saying that this the organization is trying to do something good for the people, he says that it isn't, and he's against it, and you just can't get rid of it. What can you do?
Well, if let's take this combination, the guy like this, and also he's drunk, you know. And in most cases, he will not be the guy who called the meeting. He won't be at his home. And in most cases, there'll be women there too, you know. So you start looking at the owner of the house, you know. And sort of, when he pops up, you sort of look over there, you know, sort of put pressure on that person to do something, you know. And then pretty soon, this pressure starts building in the little room or the front room. And someone, or all together, will get at him. Never fails. Just sort of, well, you're going to say something, and then he starts talking, you go, and then you look over, you know, and pretty soon you start putting the pressure over there, and everybody starts feeling kind of restless, and they take care of him. You don't argue with him, because then, but this is a way to, this is the way to get rid of him, unless you find something that interests them, and then him, and then he quits it, but in most cases you won't. And they'll say, well, usually they'll say, why don't you just hold on for a while and then let him say what he has to say, and then we can ask questions. Or you can suggest that to him directly, too.
Let me just pretend like I'm giving a short house meeting, so it won't take up too much time. I want to thank Mrs. So-and-so for inviting me here tonight to meet with you folks. She's probably told you I'm with the Migrant Opportunity, or what's the name of the program? Migrant Opportunity Program of the... it's the poverty program. This program is backed by the federal government. This is President Johnson's program. And we're here working in this neighborhood to find out if there are any people here that are interested in getting together to begin to work on the problems that they have. I've talked to Mr. Gonzalez down the street, and he was telling me about this police brutality thing that happened to his kid the other day. The cop came to the school and jerked him right out of the class and didn't even tell his parents about it. And, well, that's about right there. Probably two or three other ladies in that room are going to come in about Jose and Juan and so forth, that all happened to them too, and break right in, because that's one problem that you find wherever you go. The cops are always doing this. In some areas, they've stopped it, but not until people got organized. So they begin to talk about the problem, and then if they stop for any reason, usually they don't, then you say, well, and this other fellow was telling me about about the about the garbage problem, or the dump problem, or the water problem. You know, the sand in the water. And you talk about Guadalupe, you can just go on for 3 days and never end talking about the problems. And that the ramshackle school where they don't have anywhere near enough toilets, and then right away a number of the mothers or fathers are going to start talking about that school too. And so they talk about that a little bit, and somebody's usually going to say, "Well, yeah, but we can't do anything about those problems. We've tried, and it's just hopeless." So, have you ever had a delegation to go down and call on the school about that, or the water company, or down the police department? Well, not a delegation. I've been down there, and so on. Yeah, but what do you think if not only you went down, but say that you had a whole group of people that went down, all together, to see the police department or the school or the sanitation division about this garbage situation? Well, we haven't ever tried that. Well, you know the old one about if you just put one finger up. Why, somebody can knock it down pretty easily. If you put two fingers up, well, they can knock that down pretty easily, too. If you put three up, they can knock those down. If you put your whole hand up in the fist, they can't knock it down very easily. And that's what we're doing when we're getting organized. That's why we're here in this neighborhood, to see if there are enough of you people who would want to get together in a large number to build enough power so that when you go down to call on the sheriff, or you go down to call on the chief of police, or whoever it is you go down to call on, they'll begin to sit up and take notice. Well, somebody might say, I remember there was one organization, they did that, but they couldn't get very far. They got a little bit done. Well, how many of those people in that organization or in this community you think are registered to vote? Well, usually they don't know. But very often somebody will say, well, so if they don't know, well, then you can just go around the room. Are you registered to vote? No. Right around the room, hardly anybody's registered to vote. So you say, well, if hardly anybody in this room is registered to vote, that's probably a pretty good idea that hardly anybody else is registered here either. So I say, well, yeah, but what does the vote have to do with getting the garbage situation taken care of, or making the chief of police sit up and take notice? When you vote for somebody like that sheriff, you know. So what good does it do? Well, you take a look at your neighborhood, where we've got a pretty good idea that probably less than 10% of the people are registered to vote. Say you got 50 families here, and maybe if you're lucky, 10 of them might be, or 8 of them might be registered to vote out of 50. So when you go down to see somebody, try and get some of these problems fixed up, the guy that you're talking to is somebody that gets put in there by the vote. And what have you got to offer? 8 votes out of 50 families. What's 8 votes going to amount to as far as he's concerned, you know? But what about those people up there on, where does Goldwater live up there in?
Paradise Valley.
Up there, if something goes wrong on the street up there, somebody comes along, shoots out the light, or dumps something on the side of the road, all a housewife has to do is pick up the phone, call the sanitation department, they'll have somebody out there in half an hour. Or if there's somebody, a stranger wandering around those streets, picks up the phone, calls the sheriff's department, there'll be a squad car out there in 10 minutes. 5, if it's that close to the nearest squad car. Why? Because probably about 85 or 90% of the people up there are registered to vote. And those guys that are down and holding those offices down there know that if they don't jump when that housewife calls to them, that come next election time, that housewife is going to get all of her friends together, and they're all going to vote against the guy or the supervisor, whoever it was that had refused to help him out there. But out here in this neighborhood, what good would it do him if he did come out and do something to clean up the garbage situation or the dump situation or the guy that was wandering around here molesting children? He'd get 8 votes. Well, what does that mean to him? That's not going to win any election. And I said, well, I don't know. Maybe it sounds pretty good, but I don't know whether it works. Well, and I'll give you an example. Do all of you know Guadalupe? Well, in Guadalupe, last year, there were about 5,000 people living there. Out of those 5,000, there were 182 people registered to vote. 182 people out of 5,000, including Yaqui Indians and Mexican Americans. They didn't have a decent water supply, sand in the water, even worms. No ramshackle school building, no paved streets, no traffic lights, no stop signs, no drugstore, no doctor, no dentist, no police, no fire department. There's just a great big fat zero out there. There wasn't a single improvement that had been made by the county in the last 40 years, other than a few lights that they put up for the night ball games out there. And that was all there was. There wasn't even a public phone out there.
Mailboxes.
And no mailboxes. No. They didn't even have a postal system. So the people out there last year got organized, and they got four Yaqui Indians and four Mexican Americans sworn in as deputy registrar of voters, and they learned how to register people, and they went out from house to house for 3 weeks, day and night, until they registered 700 more people to vote, Yaqui Indians and Mexican Americans. As soon as they'd done that, they got together and organized. And they set up an action committee made up of about 25 people. And then they got all the people in the organization to tell them what their problems were that they wanted to have action taken on, that they themselves could go to work on. And this action committee then divided up the problems among the various politicians that had something to do with solving those problems. They put about 10 problems under the board, the supervisor from the area, and 4 or 5 under the state assemblyman from the area, and 4 or 5 under the federal government, under the congressman and the United States senator, for instance. Then they made delegations. And every day they'd go down and call on one of these politicians. The first one they called on was down to the supervisor, Mr. Riggs. They went down to call on Mr. Riggs. He's an attorney. And here was a blind Yaqui Indian who was the chairman of the committee, and several Mexican-American housewives, Laura Garcia and Margie Garcia, and several of the other leaders in the organization. They jam-packed his office. He sat there, you know, rustling papers back and forth, and the telephone rang, and somebody talked to him about law business, and he'd say, "I'm very sorry, but I got pretty busy, you know." And so about the third time the phone rang, why, the Yaqui Indian got in the word, said, "Mr. Riggs, we just wanted to let you know that we just finished registering 700 new voters out there." And 700 new voters, he said. "When?" "Well, we just finished day before yesterday. You'll probably get the word, just call the registrar of voters down there." "Well," said, pushed the papers aside. He picked up the phone, called his secretary, said, "Don't send any more calls. I'm going to be very busy for the rest of the afternoon. I know these people have got a lot of problems." So he hung up the phone, and said, "Well, now, what are these problems that you want to see me about?" So they said, "Well, Mr. Riggs, we want to get some stop signs out there. For one thing, we haven't got any stop signs. You've known about it for many years out there, and several kids have been hit, and adults too. And we want to get the playground fixed up. We want to get the county sprinkling system to come out and wet down the field once a week so that the little leagues can have games, because out there in the summer the dust comes up over your shoes and you can't even see the kids playing out there, that there's so much dust, you know. And we want to get a sheriff chosen from one of our own leaders to be the sheriff. Deputy Sheriff in Guadalupe, on Saturday night it gets pretty bad. It's very dangerous for the women and kids to be out at night because of the situation there. And we've never had a permanent police department, a police officer there. And we also want to get some of that old burnout diesel oil that you have put around, you've had your men from the road department put on each side of the school to protect the noses of the school teachers. Well, it's all right to protect their noses, but we want to protect the noses and the lungs of all the people in Guadalupe, too, not just the school teachers. So we want you to bring out enough old burnout diesel oil to put on all the roads, not just around the school." So as we would tell him each one of these things, he'd pick up the phone, and he called the recreation department. He made it an appointment for the head of the recreation division to come out to the Guadalupe school and have a meeting with the committee. And then we told him about the traffic situation. He called the traffic division of the county and made an appointment for the traffic man to come out. We told him about the sheriff. He made an appointment for us to go down to the sheriff's office and meet with them down there. And with the road department, the same way. He made four appointments. So when he got all through, he said, well, you see, I am starting to work on your problems right now. And running for office this year, you probably know that, and what I'd like to know is what you're going to do for me out in Guadalupe. And so this one of the housewives, I forgot, maybe it was Margie, said, Mr. Riggs, we aren't planning to do anything for you. This is a non-political organization. We do not endorse political candidates or political parties. That's another thing we want to talk about before we get through. And So we are not going to go out and campaign for you or any other politician. But I'll tell you one thing that we are going to do. We have a little newsletter that we get out every 2 weeks. The day after tomorrow, our next issue is coming out. And in that issue, we're going to tell the people about these four promises that you made. And 2 weeks later, that same newsletter is going to come out again. And if you have done anything about those stop signs or anything else, why, we're going to give you a good mark after that particular issue that you promised to help on. And we're going to keep that going right straight through the rest of the year, every week, right up until the day of election. And if by the time election comes along, you've got four good marks there in front of your name that you helped us get all those things, then everybody in Guadalupe will have been told, not once, but probably about 25 different times, that you are really trying to help them. So how can they forget that you are the man for the job? But of course, if those good marks out in front are not in front of your name out there, and we have to put a bad mark out there in front of your name, well, they'll all know that too. So somebody said, I guess you'll have to admit that that's about the best kind of publicity that any politician could get, to have his name put out there before the people week after week, providing that politician produces. Well, he had to admit it was so. 3 weeks after that, 25 stop signs went up along the streets of Guadalupe. About 2 weeks more further along, the truck from the water truck, the sprinkling truck, began coming out. Not just once a week, every single night for the rest of the summer, that truck came clear out from Phoenix and sprinkled down the part of the street and all of the playground where the little leagues were playing, all through the summer. A couple of more weeks, then by that time we'd also had the meeting with the sheriff's department, and a few more weeks went by. And a man was selected from among the top leaders in the organization, and he was trained and hired as the full-time deputy sheriff in Guadalupe. And about the same time, the road department, one morning we went out there, here were all the big earth-moving deals from the road department. They didn't just come out there to pour old worn-out diesel all over those roads. They came out to pave the roads of Guadalupe. They paved 2 miles of the roads of Guadalupe at a cost of $5,000 a mile. That's $10,000 out of the county till to pave those 2 miles of streets of Guadalupe. And the plan was to pave 2 miles every year until the full 10 miles are completed. In the meantime, we'd gotten petitions out to about 300 families to get this third-class postal system set up, and those were all sent into Washington, and delegations went down to call on the Congressman Rhodes and the Lieutenant for United States Senator Hayden, and letters went into the United States Department, Post Office Department. A few weeks later, several investigators came out, and they looked over the whole situation out there, and well, today, if you drive through Guadalupe, you'll notice a nice gleaming mailbox in front of every house out there. Before that, all it had was a few old broken down mailboxes that the drunks and everybody along go along and knock over and take the letters out and all that. or just having the mail, the rural delivery in the store. Well,